committee back to order. We're very pleased to have with us today former Representative Stacy Pitts with us, former co-chair of this committee, and to give us an opportunity to use his institutional memory and to learn more about the Act and learn more what the issues were and the thinking of the committee back in your time. Although I'm making it sound like an old time, but I go back before you anyway, so you're young in this. So thank you for being here. Thank you for your time, and I'll turn it over to you. What we're looking to, I think, to hear from is the Wind Act, what the committee looked at, what the objectives of the committee were at the time, what the goals or expectations, that kind of thing, would I think what we're looking for.
Thank you, Senator Cleveland, members of the committee. I am Stacy Pitts. I live in Pittsfield. I am here today as a former legislator, not representing anybody, anything, any company, any position. But I do appreciate the opportunity and the invite to stop in and say hi. I didn't bring guests because I did come at last session and gave you a little bit of a present anyway. And this kind of came short notice, so I didn't get a lot of time to plan. But Juliet did a very good job of kind of framing where we came from and the kinds of things that were changed when the Wind Act was passed. And I don't want to bore the committee with a complete rehash of all of that. I was trying to figure out a little bit about...
If you could give us just a brief capsule of what your role and participation
sure.
was would be helpful.
Sure. So, you know, I was elected to the legislature in 2006 for the first time, my first session in the 122nd. And at that time, I was immediately assigned to what was then the Utilities and Energy Committee. And during that period, early on, there were a lot of discussions going on related to the Reddington Black Knuble project, and that was still in its final throes, I guess. There were hearings ongoing. I did attend, as a member of the committee, one of the hearings up at Sugarloaf early on to kind of listen to that and try to understand a little more. And there were several interested parties that I think today have evolved into what is the Friends of Maine Mountains, the early kind of version of that that came from those projects. And what was apparent at that time and just observing was that there was a fairly congested and tangled permitting process for a wind project specifically, but somewhat as an offshoot of site law, the way site law was written. And I think with the final refusal of the Black Knuble project, Governor Baldacci at the time, in his review of that and all the other things that people had talked about, I mean, at that time, what was the predecessor to Kibbe had previously been permitted. Then the company that was going to develop it went bankrupt. That project never really got off the ground until later on when Kibbe was proposed and came back in a different form with more modern turbines and a different permitting process for that. I think the recognition by the Baldacci administration was that it would make sense to assemble a task force to look at wind power in general as an opportunity for the state. And then if that task force could come to an agreement, it had certain things that it was assigned to try to evaluate and answer. So as a member of the committee and a person who was assigned, one of the representatives assigned to the task force, we went through, as a task force typically does, they assemble, and this started in, let's see, I tried to write down some of the, started in May of 2007 and carried forward. That task force final report came out in February of 2008, and it met throughout that summer of 2007 through the fall, and then came together at its final meeting and voted unanimously as a task force to support the report. And one of the things in trying to read through the old report, which is still available, though it's no longer available on the state's website, it was taken down, with this administration. So I did find it online and printed out a fresh copy for myself, because I probably printed this thing out 10 times now, so I'm keeping the paper industry in business too. Page 25 of that report has a conclusion on permitting wind power development in Maine, and the paragraph, I guess, that leads off, the Wind Power Task Force is persuaded that there are a number of problems with the state's existing regulatory system, that these problems are significant and they deserve serious attention. And these problems have arisen because Maine's environmental licensing process was initially set up almost 40 years ago, long before grid-scale wind power development was seen as a viable use on the Maine, or a use of the Maine landscape. The task force has observed that these problems have resulted in considerable confusion and frustration from several perspectives, including those of developers, regulators, and other decision makers, and persons who care about expediting the development of Maine's wind resources, as well as those primarily focused on maintaining Maine's special quality of place. That's kind of the framework that the task force met under. And for me, as a legislator, when I first sat and listened to the process, because I was learning as I was going along, and trying to understand, as somebody that also served as a planning board chair in Pittsfield in a previous time, that, you know, when you're on a planning board, the one thing you don't do is spot zoning. You don't take projects individually. But the LERC process was designed to be a spot zoning process. And it specifically, as far as wind power development, it really was a spot zoning process. You picked your spot, then you go to LERC and you try to get the zoning changed. And when I looked at, for myself, how that process worked, that it was essentially a permitting process before the permitting process. All of the same types of discussions, same analysis, same everything was done during the zoning discussion, and then the project would have to go through a second round if it finally did get through the rezoning to finally get permitted by the same body if it was in the unorganized territory, which in itself seemed redundant for me, and I'm kind of a process wonk. I look at what our legislative processes create and try to find ways to make them manageable for those who have to partake, but also for the people who have an interest in bringing those issues forward, to give everybody that opportunity, but not in a redundant over and over and over process. Let's get it out there, let's do the analysis, and come back with an answer. So one of the issues that became apparent when you look at wind power in particular, and then the various mechanisms that are built into what was then LERC, was that there were some things that were already allowed as allowed uses in LERC. And those were logging, ski areas, linear projects like power lines. Those were already allowed. You didn't have to go through that zoning process at LERC if you were going to bring one of those types of projects forward. And specifically, if you look at the linear projects or the ski areas, those oftentimes were in the same areas, potentially, that a lot of the wind projects were being proposed. So the actual mechanisms that people were, as developers or somebody looking to bring a project forward, were having to go through this lengthy, uncertain, tangled process. And as a result, I agreed with the task force that this could be made better without eliminating the public input, without, you know, somehow superseding all of the opportunities that people have to bring their objections and their concerns forward, to allow somebody that's proposing a project, and I don't care whether it's a wind project, a ski area, or whatever it is, there's a process there, and that process shouldn't be so unknown for the person bringing it forward or the company bringing it forward that they can't anticipate any semblance of an outcome. You shouldn't have to gamble on permitting. It should be somewhat a process that you can look at the standard, meet the standard, and move to the next issue. In this regard, there was no way to do that. You also had that fits harmoniously thing that Juliet had brought up, that basically when the task force first met, the first thing that they had to identify was, is that a realistic standard if you're ever going to move forward and have any wind development anywhere? Can you truly be fitting harmoniously in the environment? And the answer was probably not. So that standard could always be exercised to stop something. And that just didn't make sense if you were going to actually bring forward the technology that was existing, was developing, and being improved upon as a viable resource. And I think since the Wind Act was passed, I think technologies have improved even greater. I think some of the concerns that people have raised are being addressed over time as technology improves, whether that's blade design or anything else that I've seen. But at the same time, I think we, as a legislature, looked at this when the Wind Act draft was brought forward from the task force in the same eyes that any bill comes forward to this committee or any other committee. It basically, the clock resets. I mean, the task force did its job, produced what was its opinion of the draft legislation, brought it forward through the committee process, and the committee met over several days, I've often heard that it was rammed through the legislature, and you don't get to a unanimous vote, whether it's by acclamation or otherwise, by things that are rammed through. Somebody within the body of either the Senate or the House would bring up opposition. Nobody did. This basically went under the hammer. And, that can be good, that can be bad. I've served as a legislator for 8 years, and I saw some things go through because leadership wanted it that way. But in this case, this was vetted. As a legislator, I never felt like it wasn't. And I think the public input at the time was the people that were interested parties. I think as a state, once things are in place, new opposition shows up, those people are heard, and the process continues. And I think as a legislature, if you got it 100% right, we could all just go home, and there'd be no need for the next legislature. So these things are going to always be here. We're never going to get them 100% right. But I do think it was a good piece of work. I think it did exactly what it set out to do as a bill, and that was to clean up a permitting process that was flawed, and then also to add protections that weren't even considered before. An example of that being for the smaller projects that don't trigger site law, they would slide under the radar under the existing rules. There really was no process for them other than at the local level. So what was added within the expedited wind law was another step for those projects where they'd have to go through certification and at least a review of setback, noise, sound, and shadow flicker, so that somebody actually looked at those things for those projects that came forward later. And that came mainly from the folks that had a significant opposition to the Freedom Project. I mean, they were very vocal throughout this process, as were the folks in the Mars Hill area. because those were the foundation people of what is now this fairly organized opposition to wind in general, I think. And I've sat through many hearings on this committee and heard a lot of the issues that people have brought forward, most of which I always personally felt were addressed in the law. Now, there were certainly things that were underway, like this noise review rule, that had to work through a process. And that process exists. If there are problems with the existing rules on setbacks, shadow flicker, scenic impact, as Juliet did say, is always going to be a difficult thing because it's in the eye of the beholder. I have personal views on how far I think one person on one ridge line should be able to control what happens on the other ridge line, even though you can see it. In my previous life, I worked in hydro development for a company that put a project on the New Hampshire-Vermont border on the Connecticut River, and Vermont was dictating what color paint could be used on the exterior of the project that sat in New Hampshire. I don't know how far that goes when you can see it, how much influence one entity has over another. But I think within the Wind Act, there was an acknowledgement of that fact and an ability for that process to continue to evolve. There certainly was a recognition of the areas of national and state significance would be protected. The difficulty comes into what is an area of local significance or for an individual significance. My experience has been, and I read somewhere at one point, somebody had written, don't fall in love with something that can't love you back. There's something to be said for that. And, you know, you move into an area and it looks a certain way, and progress being what it isn't always going to be that way. I know as a kid I had a favorite hunting spot that I sat for many hours on this log that wasn't that far down in the woods, but it was easy to get to, and I could grab my dad's three-wheeler and get there and set. And as time went on, that area changed, and that log now has a house sitting on it, and that area is not useful for me. And I had permission to go there, and I enjoyed that and shot several deer sitting on that log. But progress being what it is, I didn't have the money to buy it. Somebody else did, and they changed the use. Now, I don't know how far that goes. As a legislature, as we examine these things and looking forward, there has to be some understanding that those who have the rights to develop or want to exploit some resource, they ought to be able to do that. That's just the Republican in me. Not to the harm of somebody else, but certainly there is a level of balance where if you own something, you ought to be able to do it, or at least go through the process to make sure that we've protected to an extent, but not just to stop everything. And I know I've had, at times, an adversarial relationship with those who disagree with me on the wind side. That isn't for any personal gain, that's for sure, but I have my own opinions, and I've always, as a legislator, express those opinions. For those who don't know what I'm doing now, since I left the legislature, I'm actually in the natural gas business, so I don't have a vested interest in this discussion from a personal standpoint, nor did I ever, but though I'm on some websites as maybe being framed otherwise. But I just think that as the chair of the committee, what I always try to do is be deliberative. I know that you guys have carried that on and done a fabulous job of allowing the public their opportunity to petition the state and go through the due process that is the legislative process and come back with an answer. And sometimes those answers don't appeal to everybody.
Mr. Fitz, if I might interrupt for a moment.
Yep.
Having gone through the process and seeing bills being enacted, are there certain parts of it that, now that we've had some experience with it, that you would recommend that we could make changes or improvements to the bill or the act?
Well, I know that within other aspects of the legislative process that I haven't been participating in during the last session, there have been various things done to law or proposed to law. I don't really have a great opinion on whether they make sense or don't, because I haven't, and I wouldn't want to tell you how to make that choice. But I would, in my mind, say that I think you need to listen to the people who are out there that have the complaints, but also weigh that against the practicalities of the world of development and the fact that, you know, in some of those areas that people would like to always keep the way they are, there's also a need for economies, and those economies are driven by development in most cases. And having $1 billion or more spent in what is primarily areas that probably wouldn't have seen any development other than for wind, that's something to consider. I think that we have to allow the rulemaking processes to go the way they go, and the committee here or in natural resources will certainly have their opportunities. But I don't have a specific issue that I think needs an immediate piece of attention. I know some have not enjoyed the goals that are in the Wind Act. They're arbitrary in some ways. If you read through the task force report, there are a variety of potential numbers that were out there. You know, the choice of 2,000 megawatts by 2020, I've lost track. Could it have been done? Yeah, it could still be done, I guess, if the certain scenarios fell into place. But then, as a committee, you also have to consider transmission constraints, transmission issues elsewhere, and whether that's practical. But I don't know that changing those numbers affects a whole lot either. You know, it kind of goes all over the place. It really depends on who you talk to, and, you know, is there an opportunity to add clarity further than what's already there on the scenic issues? What was attempted to be done was be practical with the 8-mile discussion. Part of that, you know, though people might say that there weren't any analysis done. We did see renderings and photos and you know, what something would look like from 8 miles away versus 3 miles away. Those continue today in the permitting processes that exist so that the various entities can make those choices. Noise is out there. I think the DEP has made adjustments to that. I think we have to let those things kind of play out a little bit. But specifics, I think we improve things with it, and I'm sure this legislature has an opportunity to improve things more.
Do you have other comments you want to share?
No,
with us?
I'm fine. I've rambled enough.
Are there questions from members of the committee? Representative Dunphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have two or three around the specifics, Representative Fitz commented that that you worked for an engineering company, or you worked involved in energy, I understand, while you were a legislature. So I kind of consider you an expert. If you So perhaps you can answer this. Do you still think that the 2,000 megawatt goal is realistic? Or should we go back and take a look at that? We're at 400 or 500 now, right?
Yeah, and I appreciate the question. The issue is whether the date is right. You know, is that too aggressive? Is it what does it do? And does it have an impact beyond at least a statement that we acknowledge that there, as a state, is a potential there? 2,000 is certainly doable in the mechanical engineering side. Whether 2,000 is doable because of organized opposition in certain areas that have boxed out potential development, I don't know. That analysis, you heard reference to the Bob Grace study. It all came as a result of a multi-level analysis of the wind resources that exist, the sites that are available, various adjustments to what the potential was and then what the likelihood based on scenic impacts and otherwise of certain areas. And that's actually a honed down number quite a bit from what the real potential was. But at the same time, you need investors to want to put that much in, and you also need to get that power to the people who want it, which also has a limiting factor that whether that's practical.
A couple more. One, from what I've read, part of it was to minimize our dependency on foreign oil. It was part of the justification. Can you respond to the extent that foreign oil dependency has been addressed by any of the land-based wind? And sort of going on to that, do you think that the assumptions included in the Wind Act were a bit overstated? And one more, I'll just group these all together and be done with it. I think on some of the permitting, there's a design or an installed capacity assumption, projected capacity, and an actual capacity. Do you know what those numbers look like collectively for the state of Maine?
Probably on the last. That's not something that I've been involved in as far as the specifics of, you know, the units that are there today, how they've performed, whether there are other factors involved that impact what the output of those are. Some projects haven't produced as well as they probably should have because of mechanical difficulties. The same thing happened in the hydro industry in the 80s when hydro plants were being proposed and built that then turned out to have gearbox issues because engineering design adopted certain technologies. As far as the issue of capacity and whether we've met our or having an impact on oil or fossil fuels in general, because I think you have to kind of lump all of that together. Sometimes in the analysis, oil was the focus. I think if you look at what ISO's proposing for this winter, oil comes back into play. If capacity issues on gas are being addressed with backup oil and dual fuel, then we are going to be burning more oil. And I, as somebody that has spent a lot of time in the hydro world, that's primarily where my expertise lies. Hydro plants typically on a run-of-river basis are designed to about a 45% capacity factor. Any of the back-of-the-napkin calculations I've ever done on wind projects, they aren't viable unless you can get them to 30% capacity factor, so that's affected by resource and technology. Once you get to 30% capacity factor, the numbers start to work better.
Do we have any there at 30%?
I don't know what the capacity factors are right now. I know, in the early days of Mars Hill was overproducing what they originally thought, and it had capacity factors in the early days up over 40%, closer to what a standard run-of-river hydro would have. I think all of those things, from the engineering side, those are questions that developers need to address. because it gets into return on investment for a developer.
But if we're subsidizing it to the extent that we are, mm-hmm. it seems like as legislators, we should have access to that information. And I know there's and I understand there's, you know, there's proprietary stuff and there's but they're asking, they being the industry, is asking, in my opinion, for huge amounts of subsidies that are in some cases driving our energy costs up. And that being said, they're withholding the information. So we read a lot of assumptions, we hear a lot of assumptions, a lot of claims are made, but you know, there's no way to substantiate them. So I sort of struggle with that from a policy standpoint.
And I think the discussion on what are subsidies that are real, manageable, make sense, that's a discussion that goes on from every political body that exists. One of the things that's always bothered me as a Maine legislator is that we compare ourselves to places in other parts of the country, Pacific Northwest being one of the primary ones, where, you know, we like to talk about how high our energy costs are here as opposed to other places. And, you know, there's not a place in the United States that's probably more subsidized from the federal end than the Pacific Northwest. Now, Tennessee Valley, not anymore. I mean, at one time, Tennessee Valley was, but Tennessee Valley tends to be, you know, the original developments that created the TVA are long gone. I mean, in the overall, TVA is a much bigger animal than what was originally created. But the Bonneville Power Authority and some of the other entities that exist in the Pacific Northwest, I mean, if you try to understand why their rates are so low, they were built by the federal government. Now, if the federal government came in here today and said, we'll build 5,000 megawatts of wind, we would fight that, saying that was a bad idea. Now, in the Pacific Northwest, when they proposed to build lots of hydro, that was a good idea for them. And it changed their whole makeup and gave them Boeing and Alcoa and some of the other entities that exist there that we could never even dream of attracting. So subsidies are all relative, I guess. And so I've always struggled in the argument against when we're comparing ourselves to those who have been subsidized before us.
12%.
I don't know if I answered all your questions, but I'll try.
Thank you.
Representative Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to have you before our committee, Mr. Fitz, and I presume that the cookies that are behind us were actually from you.
No, they were. Sorry. I'm not going to take credit for those.
I was trying to help you out. A couple of things that I continue to hear from people, and I think it really comes down to people that I hear from who are opposed to wind power do not feel that they've been heard. And I think that reasonable people can disagree on that. So I wasn't, as you know, I've followed the Energy Committee on certain issues, namely efficiency, for many years, but this is my first session actually being on it. So I just want to hear from you whether you feel that the process all along was open, whether it was transparent, and whether people had an opportunity to be heard, because not having been here, I can't speak to that to folks.
I never felt like the process was closed or not public, or whether it be at the task force level or when it came to the legislature in the end, or even going further beyond that over the years of all the various issues that have come forward. You know, several of the people who came to the task force, I had lunch with privately, you know, that were in just guttural opposition to the whole concept. I've always tried to make this as much an open process, if I had any influence over it, as I could. I don't always agree. And I don't think committees always agree with some of the issues that are brought forward, and that's all part of that balancing act of the process itself. I think going forward, you know, and looking at the permitting, that's certainly an extremely public process, and I don't know how anybody could ever say that they weren't given an opportunity to participate.
I have a couple of questions, if that's all right. I've been sort of sitting here listening. So we hear, the other thing I hear a lot about is the subsidies. And I guess for me, that argument doesn't really hold water, largely because it's predicated, I'm sorry, I can't hear. It's predicated on the idea that we're only subsidizing wind. And it's also predicated on the idea exclusively of direct subsidies as opposed to indirect subsidies such as externalized costs that may come with other sources of fuel. For example, coal tends to be 3 cents a kilowatt hour, which is, or thereabouts. But as we know, coal also requires, in some cases, the complete blowing up of mountaintops. More important to Maine, and more specific to Maine, we have one of the highest cancer and asthma rates in the country, and there's common sense would suggest that if we happen to be the tailpipe of the coal industry, which we are, that there may be a correlation between those two things. And so while other part regions of the country may get lower energy costs, the externalized costs end up on Maine healthcare shoulders. So could you speak, that's a big piece of...
There's a lot there.
Yeah, could you unpack that and just speak to it based on, I mean, you've been on the committee, you were on the committee for many, many years.
You know, it does go back to the issue that we have by being in New England as opposed to being in Ohio. But at the same time, you know, there are other things about living in New England that are better than living in Ohio, I would hope.
Or cooler.
Not given the temperatures in the last few days. But, you know, this issue of subsidy is never going to go away. There's always somebody out there that's going to get a little more, and I do think any effort to try to capture the externalities in cost does balance us and the things that we deal with here versus what others don't want to talk about or push back from. You know, for me, the subsidy issue, you know, specifically as far as the state goes, is probably most wrapped up in renewable portfolio standards. That's probably the biggest item. And I think if you look at our overall costs of electricity, it's a sliver in our overall costs, and we can fight about that till we're blue in the face and bruised and battered, but it won't do anything of any consequence to our overall electric rate. Even if we would eliminate all of it everywhere, it's very, very small in the overall. So I don't disagree with you. I you know, it's a fact of life, and I think the only control as Maine legislators we typically have is how what we do for ourselves, and I know it's not necessarily always echoed in a friendly way, but you know, Maine does have traditionally the lowest rates in New England. We're doing something right compared to our neighbors. Now, does that last forever? No, we're also at the benefit of the fact that there's some constraint there on transmission, and if we relieve the constraint, those prices will probably more equalize. We've done a pretty good job of balancing one against the other. There are so many pieces to the whole discussion, and this committee spends hours and hours and hours reviewing them each session. So
there's also a difference in, you know, this significant federal subsidy. Thank you. Sorry, sir. I did say I had a few questions.
We tend to be more conversational.
You asked two, but you may ask a third.
I was just saying that when you look at oil and gas, it's heavily subsidized at the national level, at the federal level. And when you're competing with those, all we can do is to provide subsidies to help compete. But the last question that I have relates to the big picture. So I'm open to constructive tweaks to a policy, and I hear from opponents both some constructive pieces, but then this overarching idea that if we don't absolutely do away with any sort of industrial wind whatsoever, that we haven't done our job. And so I'd like to hear from you on that. I mean, you and I regulated the alcohol industry. I'll use one term, wine tasting, that will make both of us cringe. every single year there are tweaks to the bill, doesn't necessarily mean that we should go back to prohibition per se. So I'd just like to hear your thoughts on, you know, the idea of constructive tweaks versus just throwing the entire wind energy industry out the window, because that's what I'm hearing from folks, and, you know, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think when legislators look at how they make their decisions and what they agree or disagree with that, on issues that are brought forward, polling has a lot to do with the overall posture and mindset of people in the decision-making process. You have to consider that. And as much as it is a difficult thing, people who oppose tend to be more engaged than people who don't. So that's a piece of what drives the legislative process. That's just the realities of how things are. You know, I think you have to let the process continue and do the best thing you can and not feel guilty about what you do later, because you did that with the best information you had at the time.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Neuendijk.
Thank you. I have a document in front of me that indicates three other New England states have placed a moratorium on wind farms. I haven't had the opportunity to verify whether or not that's correct, but if it is, can you think of some reasons why they felt it necessary to put a moratorium on their wind farms?
I mean, I've only watched what other states have done kind of from afar. I certainly, you know, when you get into some parts of this, the New England region especially, there is a lot more development that covers a bigger territory, and so there's less room for other things. Wind tends to take up space. There isn't a lot of space available in many of those states where you're not sitting right on top of somebody else. And that in itself may drive a larger contingent of people to come forward and make those suggestions. I'm not a big fan of moratoriums. I'd rather get to the issue and resolve the issue directly and not just say no to everything. But other states handle it their own way. And you know, Maine has a moratorium process that's allowed in communities for a short term while they resolve it and come up with final decisions. And I think those processes are, you know, just part of what's embedded in what we do. But, you know, why other states do what they do is best left to them. I can't guess beyond that.
Any other questions for Mr. Fitz? Mr. Fitz, thank you so much for your time.
I hope it was helpful. I do appreciate the opportunity to come back. I always enjoy being here, and you may see me again in wearing my other hats, but I do appreciate the opportunity, and if anybody has questions afterwards, feel free to seek me out.
Thank you, and it's great to have the opportunity to get your institutional memory.
Thank you.
I want to take an opportunity next to hear from Representative Dunphy.
Would you prefer that I go out there?
Yeah, I think yes, I would.
Okay. All right, thank you. Thank you, Chairs. I appreciate being afforded this opportunity. I was asked by a group of my constituents to express their concern. And we talk about, Representative Russell talked about, I think, transparency. And I'd like to read a short excerpt from an email that was sent, it looks like 17 January 2008 at 2:26 p.m. And it says, and part of this, and I'm taking it out of context, but it says to hold individual meetings with ENGOs and developers, and there are some names here, to go over draft report, and if possible, develop a map of the area where expedited reviews will take place. Agreement would be that what is said in these meetings is confidential among the parties. And another part of it says, if agreement is reached on a map, parties would sign an agreement to support the map publicly and privately and resist efforts to change it in the legislature. So that doesn't sound clear and transparent to me, but that's just my take on it.
Yes, related to these comments?
Yes, I just wanted to know the context for that. I got the date of the email and the time.
I'll talk with you offline if you don't mind.
That would be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Clear and transparent. again, I was asked to express the some of the feelings of my constituents. And I think I'll start with the short one. It seems to me there is a general consensus that our great state of Maine has great natural resources and scenery that attracts visitors from all over the world. Indeed, a Brookings Institute report commissioned by the state in 2007 claims that our quality of place is our state's greatest asset. Since we know that all the premise upon which the wind law was enacted in 2008 have either changed or been refuted, and data shows that the existing wind sites perform poorly. Don't we owe it to the citizens of the state to be responsible to revise the law that provides expedited permitting and other favorable treatment to the wind industry rather than continue to destroy hundreds of miles of Maine's uplands to fulfill an arbitrary goal of 2,700 megawatts of installed capacity by 2020? Furthermore, in view of our state's expanding their percentages to the arbitrary RPS goals, it seems to me it comes down to two renewable resources, Canadian hydro or wind turbines in Maine. Shouldn't we revamp the wind law so that other states do not take advantage of easy access to Maine to fulfill their goals? If Maine's goal will result in upwards of 1,500 turbines sprawled over 300 miles of destroyed ridges, imagine quadruple that amount to satisfy Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. What is the public policy obligation to the citizens of the state, many of whom have petitioned two legislators for change in the wind law? Will our legacy be that we allowed a special interest free reign to destroy our vaulted quality of place and ignore our own citizens? Will we turn vacation land into wind turbine plantation, where views from Mount Katahdin, from Acadia National Park, from Mount Blue State Park, and from other vista points throughout the magnificent Western Mountains contain hundreds of wind turbines? It is already happening. Shouldn't we recognize the cumulative impact and say enough already? That's the easy one. This one came from actually a number of constituents, and it's titled a press statement by Citizens Task Force on Maine Wind Power. It's an open letter to the EUT committee members. And it starts, "We are insulted but not surprised that this committee has chosen to hear only from the established industrial wind industry personified by Juliet Brown and Stacey Fitz. Brown is the attorney for most of the industrial wind developers in Maine, and former legislator Fitz was working for a company with wind company contracts when he chaired the EUT committee. Brown was instrumental in drafting the Expedited Wind Act, which greatly benefits her clients and therefore Ms. Brown herself. Both she and Mr. Fitz are vocal cheerleaders for industrial wind. Do you realize, or do you really expect to receive an impartial assessment?" And though, let me interrupt here. I think they did a great job, and I do believe it was relatively impartial. Do you really expect to receive an impartial assessment of the act from Brown and Fitz? Not surprisingly, though, it is clear that you do not want an impartial assessment, since you have not done anything in response to the OEIS report, Maine Wind Assessment 2012. This committee itself requested that report in 2011, and it was given to you in March 2013 by Patrick Woodcock of the OEIS. The report makes 25 recommendations to correct flaws in the wind permitting law. How many of those recommendations has this committee addressed or otherwise considered? Over the last 4 years, you've heard hundreds of hours of testimony in this very room from outraged, pleading, desperate, discouraged, dejected, and depressed citizens from every part of Maine who are exposed or potentially exposed to the nightmare of industrial wind power. Yet you've done nothing at all to respond to their pleas. You act as though the citizens are your servants, not the other way around. For years, you've listened to the wind industry and the big green, the major environmental groups who care more for their own financial survival than for the people who are being harmed by suffering noise impacts, decreased property values, violations of their civil rights, and other impacts. You've continually upheld the arguments of the wind industry that any change to the law would negatively affect their profit margins and scare away investors. You've never questioned the low output of the turbines already up. You've never questioned how many jobs they really provide and who the jobs are given to. You choose, however, to kill all the bills that we have proposed and use the study only as a way to avoid taking action. Today's agenda includes no consideration of the report, nor of the OEIS and the DEP views and concerns as expressed in the EUT meeting of 7 May 13. When the wind law was passed, nobody in the legislature considered that reaching the goals expressed in the law would require more than 300 miles of mountain ridges be lined with turbines as tall as a 50-foot skyscraper, or that the noise of these behemoths would negatively impact the health of Mainers. No one discussed the thousands of birds, bats, and raptors that would be killed or lost to habitat, or the loss of habitat destruction, and no one knew that the thousands of turbines would yet yield less than 5% more electricity to the grid with CO2 savings of only 1%. But now you know. While it's too late for the Mars Hill, the Boundary Mountains, Freedom, Vinyl Haven, Lincoln, Burlington, Lee, Stetson Mountain, Danforth, Roxbury, Blue Hill, Estabrook, and Spruce Mountains, it is not too late for the rest of Maine. We demand some action now from this committee. Do what you were sent to Augusta to do. Represent your constituents. It's not your job to represent energy-greedy residents of other New England states. It's not your job to represent the executives of out-of-state wind corporations. It's not your job to represent attorneys and lobbyists employed by Portland law firms. Your job is to represent the people of this state, and you have failed miserably in that task.
Thank you, Mr. Duffy. I mean, as I said earlier about my efforts to get other voices, and I made an effort to do that.
Yes, sir, I do.
First of all, let me thank you for making the presentation. One of the things that I think is vitally important is that we listen to not dissenting views, and I always want to make space for that, always try to. Having said that, and all of us who serve in this role, do the very best we can to listen to all the voices. I know that sometimes people will come to a conclusion because the decision we make perhaps seems to be more in line with a particular or group of interests than others. That does not mean that there's a direct connection between the two. What it means is we try to think and balance all of the needs for the people of Maine, which is a very, very daunting and difficult job. And so I want to assure people, certainly for I, and I think I can speak for every single member on this committee, that we take our responsibilities very seriously, and that we will try to look at the merits and the issues of the case and do not do so solely as being a spokesperson or mouthpiece for any particular interest at all. So having said that, I know that the outcomes always aren't what others, what everybody would want, but it's critically important people understand that I am not aware of a single person on this committee who is speaking solely from the perspective of a single interest. to do that. And having you and many others on the committee make sure we don't do that. And I value your input greatly. Representative Rikerson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really just a point of information. Out of the 30 or something letters I got, why did you choose to read that latest one? The people were insulted. Was that? I mean, I just am curious what set that letter aside from the others.
See, because this is the one that someone asked me to read.
Oh, okay.
One of these two, I was asked to read them, I'm down here to represent my constituents.
I understand,
and I take that obligation seriously.
Thanks.
Representative Gideon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dunphy, I know you and Representative Russell had an exchange about this, but I just want to comment the email that you read a piece of. It is difficult to hear that email because it sort of has this damning aspect to it, quite honestly, without knowing what the context is. And to have it read publicly, but then to not be able to say publicly where it comes from or what it is difficult as a legislator sitting up here. So I want to make that comment. In the first email that you read, would you mind just opening it up again and reading the part that had to do with RPS? It was from the first email that you read from a citizen, the shorter email.
You like me to read it again?
I think there was a one or two sentences about the renewable portfolio standard, because I just had a question, but I wanted to hear it again first.
Certainly, go ahead.
Furthermore, in view of other states expanding the percentages of their arbitrary RPS goals, it seems to me it comes down to two renewable sources, Canadian hydro or wind turbines in Maine. Was that enough? All right.
Any further questions, Representative Dunphy? Thank you very much for making that presentation. We will take a half an hour break for lunch, and then we'll return to hear from the Ice on the Wingland folks.